The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report, Monday afternoon in sunny California. On the line, the one man who has survived the BS Report jinx from the Phoenix Suns. He's on the Subway Fresh Take hotline. Jared Dudley, congratulations on the big sweep.
Hey, man. Hey, it was big for us. Big for Phoenix today. Getting that sweep, man. I'm happy. Happy I could be a part of it.
You guys kind of felt after game two, because I happened to be in the locker room that day, it seemed like you guys were pretty confident that you could actually go into San Antonio. Maybe not sweep, but definitely win a game. Were you surprised by the sweep?
You know, I was definitely surprised, man. We were confident all along. You know, we wanted to play the Spurs. We played well with them during the regular season. We knew playoffs would be different. But this was, you know, we had home court advantage, and we got up 2-0. Our mindset is we can definitely win one. We thought in the regular season we should have beat them at their place, but Jay Rich missed that one dunk. But to go in there and sweep them like we did, I don't think anyone can imagine it, but it was perfect, especially for guys like Steve and Amari.
Right. You guys won game two, which I went to. It was, you kind of won it ugly. You didn't shoot well in the first half. You came in with Amundsen, and he crashed the offensive boards a little bit, kind of changed the game. But it was one of those games that it felt like the Spurs were going to come back, and they just never did. In the last, like, 4 minutes, last 3 or 4 minutes, from their body language, it felt to me like they kind of deep down knew they weren't going to beat you. Could you guys sense that or no?
You know, I definitely thought that. I thought that you could tell the free throw line. You could tell every time we had big runs and hit big shots. Every time they went on a run, we responded. I just thought the bench, you know, we played exceptionally well. The starters took us home, and you could definitely tell this team is not the same Phoenix Sun team 4 or 5 years ago. We can play defense. We can win in different ways, unlike years past.
And heading into this Spurs series, you probably, because this was your first one, but you could probably sense in Phoenix there was that feeling of, uh-oh, here are the Spurs. They're going to come ruin everything. Do you guys, how do you tune that out?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, I took it as a challenge. I took it, you know, you could definitely feel in the locker room that it was a little more tense in the sense that the guys wanted this one a lot more than most ones. You could tell Steve, I know he mentioned to me before, he's never beaten the Spurs ever in his career in playoffs. He was more serious. He was more vocal in the locker room before the games about this. And in the city, on my Twitter page, it was always telling me that, hey, you know, do this one for me, Jerry. You know, we've never beaten them. But we kind of zoned out the way, hey, man, let's go in there. Let's take care of business. We're supposed to win. We have home court advantage, and let's do what we're supposed to do. And that's what we did.
Dragic in game three. Have you ever seen anything like that?
We call him Go On Jordan after that performance. It was 23 and a quarter. Man, it was like, yeah. I don't remember him scoring before the fourth quarter, but he took over at the right time. It was kind of like a Golden State style offense. We were playing one-on-one pickup. They were switching every screen and roll. So we used to pick and roll, and then Duncan or Blair was guarding him, or him and Barbosa. And we just basically spread the floor, and, you know, and Gorn did what he did best, was knocking down jump shots, got confidence, and, man, after LeBron put on his show, Gorn matched it and added a couple more points to it.
I liked at the end, right after the game ended, you guys all surrounded him, and it just felt totally genuine to me. Like, you know, I think the difference with this Suns team versus a lot of the teams that not only we're seeing this year, but just in general, is that guys seem like they really do care about each other, and nobody really cares who wins the game as long as you guys win. Is that accurate?
Oh, very accurate. I mean, for example, I mean, game three, you know, I played the whole, mostly the fourth quarter. I didn't score 1 point, and it didn't even matter.
Right.
Warren has, like I said, 23. I mean, this team is unselfish. Guys, stars are on the bench. You got Amari Stoudemire basically not playing the whole fourth quarter, and
yeah,
we win game three. Man, guys have definitely put their egos in check. You know, no one's worried about, you know, a salary or your payday. People are winning about trying to advance. And this is a series of, hey, however we got to do it, let's do it. And when a guy in front of you is producing, you clap it up for him. You're genuinely happy for that person.
Why couldn't the Spurs stop what you guys were doing with those screens and all that stuff in the perimeter? Like, did they just not have the right personnel?
They don't have the right personnel. They, you know, for one, they're a lot smaller. You know, they're going small ball. That's not Spurs style. They don't ever. Spurs in the past have been a team that's a veteran, tall, big, scrappy, holds you. You know, the Kurt Thomases, the Robertos, the Bruce Bowens, they don't have that right now. They got the Rich Jeffersons, the Blairs, you know, the George Hills that are young. We basically was leaving Richard Jefferson wide open. We was doubling off on making him shoot jump shots. We thought that was an advantage. You know, we could tell that he wasn't into it. We kept their bench down. You know, Blair, we kept them off the boards, and they don't have a lot of personnel. They're not really athletic for the most part, and you know, we definitely capitalized on that.
Yeah, you could see game two. Jefferson had a really good game statistically. But and he went like 8 for 13. But you guys wanted him to shoot all 13 of those shots, and he wasn't crazy about shooting any of them. It was pretty clear that you guys were basically daring him to be the guy who beat you. I don't know if you can do that against the Lakers. Have you thought about that series at all?
You definitely can't. You know, every team presents a different challenge. You know, we was trapping Aldridge more than we trapped Tim Duncan. If you notice it, Tim Duncan's a better player. But it depends on what hurts us. Athleticism to a certain point hurts us, especially if you're a big. Yeah. We can't trap like that, but we'll run our tests. I know he doesn't shoot a high percentage. We'll make him make some threes early on. And our bench has to outplay their bench. You know, our bench has been key for us all season. The Lakers bench hasn't been as good this year as it has been in years past. And that's a big team. You know, they're going to have to rebound for the most part, but yeah, we're definitely going to have to play a different strategy towards them as we did San Antonio.
Yeah, because it seems like in the playoffs, the best lineup that you guys have had has been when you're out there with Grant Hill, with Richardson, with Nash, and with Amari, which is basically small ball. But against the Lakers, if they put the two trees out there, I'm not saying you can't do it. I just think, you know, you're going to have to be the one who guards Gasol or Andrew Bynum. Have you ever guarded anybody who that tall?
You know what? I guard Dirk, but the different type of players, more on the perimeter. And I guarded Bosch early in the year, and he's more perimeter. You know, he didn't really post me up. He really caught, you know, pick and pop they were doing. The key for us is going to be Amari getting you guys in foul trouble. He's going to have to be aggressive on Gasol and Bynum and get one of them in foul trouble, hopefully Gasol. But if it's Bynum, then bring Lamar in. And once they bring Lamar in, we can then go small, because Lamar Odom's basically a small forward. You know, he's not really a powerful. He's an outside. And if they bring him in the fourth quarter, which they usually do most times anyway, we can then go to our best defensive lineup. But that means – go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, Odom is somebody that's always killed Phoenix for some reason. I'm sure you've heard that. I don't know why, but he's always been a guy that in past years has had success. I guess the difference in this series would be, you know, Oklahoma City gave the Lakers a real run in round one, and they did it with a small lineup that is pretty similar to the lineup that you guys succeed with, but you would be in the Jeff Green role, which means I guess you'd be guarding Gasol. Could you handle Gasol?
You know what? Green's a little bit bigger than me and more of a natural four than I am. I mean, I can't say I can guard Gasol. I mean, I'm going to make it difficult. If I would, I would front him as much as I can, make sure the help side's behind me. But yeah, you're right. You know, with me and I could just see Coach, if we went small ball, Lamar Odom would have to be in the game. I think that if they went big like that, I think Channing would get more playing time in that sense. Now, if he was struggling and somehow he wasn't getting it done, we would go small ball. But I have no problem guarding Gasol or, you know, anyone in the sense that, hey, they run a triangle, we'd have to be more scrappy. And with our team, and when we go small, we're a lot better at switching and communicating and talking and just using our basketball instincts out there.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this because obviously I want you guys to win, not just because I like watching you, but I'm a Celtic fan. I hate the Lakers. So nothing would make me happier than you beating the Lakers. I don't know if anybody is going to beat them by matching what they do. Like, they have the best size in the league, for lack of a better term, and it seems like the way to beat them would be by not trying to match their size and not doing it as well, but by beating them, as Barkley said last night, by outscoring them, by changing the tempo of the game, by trying to turn it into a typical Phoenix game, a 115 to 110 type game, making them run, making them pound it into Gasol and Bynum, and making Kobe give up shots, which, you know, sometimes he's not that crazy about doing. I think you have a chance. How do you get them to change that tempo, though? How do you impose that on them?
Well, it's kind of like, you know, the Portland series. Every time we slowed the ball up, we lost. Anytime the game was unmatched, you have to speed it up. And how you speed up is by getting stops. We don't have to match them when it comes to size, like, hey, we got to play 2 7-footers out there. But we have to, you know, build a rebound. So that's going to be crucial. Us getting the rebounds, getting out, has to be a transition game. It has to be. Because once they get in their half-court defensive set, they're hard to score on because they're so big. The pick and rolls, they clog the lane. And they have Kobe and Artest to contest shots, which is very difficult. But if you get the team in transition, they're not good. Artest is not really good for full court. Kobe is, Gasol and Bynum running up and down. They don't want to run. You know, those guys, you know, you see Bynum's knee bracing. He don't want to run them down. So you have to get it, up and down game. And by that, you got to get stops.
Right. Are you excited to spend 4 to 5 days in Los Angeles?
You know I am.
What does this mean for the JMZ brand?
You know, I'll probably do it. You know what? I don't know if you've seen. You know, I did a video for TMZ lately. So I'll probably do another video for them in, like, out of town in L.A. And then JMZ, you know, just doing interviews. You know, ESPN's right there, so I might have to go over to the network and put myself on.
Yeah, maybe we'll get you on the Nighttime Sports Center. Maybe you have to make a cameo.
Make a cameo? You're the one with the 2 million followers on Twitter. I'm trying to be like you.
Well, I like the fact that I saw you tweeted that you guys went to go see Iron Man 2 between games in San Antonio, and like 10 guys went. How many guys from the team actually went to that?
You know what? I want to say like 90% of the guys. You know,
yeah.
Steve was there. Our owner was there. You know what? You know, guys have usually gone in the past, you know, it'd be like 6 or 7 guys. That was the first time. It was about 90% of our team there watching it. You know, people were a little disappointed. They thought the last one was better. But for the most part, man, it's cool that you see guys hanging out like that on the road.
Yeah, it sounds silly and it sounds like a cliche, but it does seem like when something really good is happening for a team, and I'm not saying you guys overachieve, but definitely, you know, I think you've surprised people to some degree, and I think you're maximizing the potential of the team you have. It does seem like stuff like that starts happening. The entire team goes out to dinner. The entire team goes out to the movies. And you had some success at Boston College, similar run. Was that team like that?
Yeah, you know what? You know, that's my personality. As you see with the JMZ videos, I'm gonna make sure that we all get along, have fun, hang out. We have guys like that too. Grant, Amari's like that. You know, I'll tell Steve, hey, you gotta roll with us because he likes to stay in his hotel room a little too much. So we'll get him up out of there occasionally. You gotta do that, man. We're on the road way too long to not hang out. And I just think you're more successful that way, to be honest with you. You know, if you like each other, you don't mind passing to a teammate that's open. You don't mind, you know, hanging out with a guy. So, you know, we forced down this team when it comes to my interviews, when it comes to hanging out. And because of that, that's where we're at.
Well, in Charlotte, that team really wasn't like that.
You know what? We hung out a lot. We just kept getting our butt kicked. You know what? It was crazy. Hey, we hung out. We were friends. We did this. We did that. But we could never find a way to get wins. But we were just young. You know, it happens sometimes like that.
Who was more emotional in the locker room last night, Nash or Granhill?
I would say Nash. I would say Nash, man. Like, man, you know all about his success, and two-time MVP, all what he does for us, man. But this series, you could tell he wanted this run. You know, he could say the political correct answer to the media. I felt it. I wanted to win more for him than anything. You know, I want to do all little things because, you know, he's never beat him. You know, he had the busted nose when Robert Horry got him. He had the busted eye because Tim Duncan got him. And he's fought in there. He's been the leader the whole year. And you know what? It kind of validates him a little bit. You know what? Hey, you know what? I got the Spurs in L.A. Now I'm going back to the Western Conference Finals. Hey, no one's going to pick us to beat the Lakers. Let's be honest. Now you're 4 wins away to the NBA Finals.
I might pick you because for a couple reasons. But one, I want to root for it. But also, it's a nice theory of my whole thing that it was a big part of my book about whether chemistry can trump talent. If the talent is close enough with the two teams, can the chemistry win out? This is a perfect test case for this.
Very, very much so. You know, but I wouldn't say the Lakers are not, the Lakers don't have chemistry. You know, you're right. Chemistry definitely outweighs talent, just like heart outweighs talent. But the key is going to be for us is dictating our style. And we can't do it for three quarters. This is a team that you have to shoot the ball well. I mean, let's be honest, for the most part in San Antonio, we didn't shoot the ball extremely well. But we won with defense. We're going to have to shoot the ball. Our three-point shots got to be on because it opens up the floor. And once we get these big guys running out on us, getting in the lane, kicking out for threes, and it's going to be difficult. But, hey, you know, we wouldn't want it any other way.
What did Nash's eye look like last night, about an hour after that game?
It looked like Mike Tyson after Buster Douglas knocked him out. I mean, it was all black and blue. Couldn't see out of it. We were making fun of him. But you know what? I remember him saying that he'll take a black eye beating the Spurs.
Yeah.
You know, he'll take that one. Yeah, I mean, it was crazy, man. He couldn't even see it. He was shooting jump shots with one eye. And I'm not just making that up. That's why you saw him miss that leaner he did. He shot the leaner probably like six times, and he missed all six of them.
Yeah.
But he hit that three, hit that floater. I mean, true warrior, and I'm glad that, you know, this series, that series win was for him.
I don't think people understand how hard it would be to make a three-pointer with one eye.
I mean, most people in the NBA can't make it with two eyes. I mean, you only imagine. Let's be honest.
To not have depth perception, kind of an important thing when you're trying to score in a high-pressure playoff basketball game. I thought that was crazy. You know, I tweeted this during the game. For some reason, you know, he's our top Canadian basketball player, and he's the guy who gets these weird hockey injuries. Like 2 years ago, he had the busted top of his nose, was bleeding all over the place, then he gets this thing. It's like the Canadian thing trumps basketball, and he has to get weird hockey injuries. I hope that stops.
It's got to stop. Yeah. We need that dude 110%. He can't even be 100. He got to be feeling like his rookie year, you know, especially now. People understand all what he does, man, when it comes to, like, his conditioning. And he has the ball in his hand throughout the whole game coming off those screen and rolls. I mean, that's tiring, and we didn't need him to be 100%, definitely.
Now, I was in Phoenix, and people were talking about your feet. You apparently have legendary feet in the Phoenix locker room. Is this true?
Legendary feet or legendary hands? I don't know if I got legendary feet.
Feet. I heard your feet were extremely flat.
I'm definitely flat-footed, yes.
Like they, definitely. Like people look at them and they don't understand how you can jump with the feet you have.
Yeah, you know what? It was what I was blessed with. I mean, I used to ask my mom all the time, like, why do I have flat feet like this and no one else in the family does? It's crazy, right? You know what? That's probably why I'm not too athletic when jumping-wise.
Well, can't they put, like, the sneakers? They give you the arches, though, right?
Oh, I got arches in my sneakers. Yeah, I definitely do. No,
I kind of wanted to see them. Next time we're together, I'd like to look at your feet.
Yeah.
It sounds fascinating. You shouldn't be able to be playing crunch time on a potential finals team with flat feet. What happens if you make the finals? I mean, I see the JMZ thing if you make the finals. I think you become one of the big celebrities in the world, I think.
Yeah, I'll probably throw a party at the W here in Phoenix. We're going to the finals now. Hey, we went to the finals, man. The city was shut down. The city was definitely shut down.
You think so?
I think so.
The whole Los Suns, that whole thing, were you worried that was going to be a bigger deal maybe than it ended up being for game two?
No, I think that if people didn't think it was going to be a big deal, they're crazy. You definitely knew it was going to be a big deal. Let's be honest, man. The immigration law passing and you taking a stance during a playoff game wearing a jersey, you know it's going to ruffle some feathers, but our owner felt strongly about it. He came to the team, you know, during a shoot around and said, hey, you know, something I want to do. You guys for this? If you're not, speak up. Steve spoke up and said that he was for it. Mari said he was for it. And when the two captains say it, we fall in line. And I had no problems with it.
Yeah. Well, there you go. I thought it was cool. I mean, I thought that because you could say it was Cinco de Mayo, too, so it wasn't. 100%, plus you guys are undefeated when you wear those jerseys. I mean, you got to factor that into the whole thing. I think you got to break them out for the next round, whether it's a political statement or not.
You're into these jinx and stuff. I keep hearing about your show, the jinx. You know, you got the BC report jinx, and you know, you don't worry about the jerseys. You worry about you got to worry about your opponent. Hey, if we wore those jerseys versus, you know what, Memphis Grizzlies, you know, or you know the Minnesota, you know, you're gonna have a better record than you ever versus Lakers.
Well. You are obviously not worried about the jinx because you came on the BS report even after I warned you that we've had some some failures in the past, and you have taken the BS report jinx and buried it.
Buried
as far
it.
As I am concerned. Yeah. Last thing, Kobe. So you could potentially guard everybody from Kobe to Pau Gasol in this series. You talked about the last time you were on, you talked about that Kobe is probably a little bit easier to guard than he was in years past because he does so much more post up and power move stuff like that, which is kind of in your wheelhouse to defend. I'm not saying you're going to stop it, but
definitely not.
Are you the best guy in the Suns to defend him?
I would say me and Grant have the best chance. You know what? I like if me and Grant are in it for Grant to guard him because I could trap him. Man, I love trapping guys that don't want to give the ball up. You know, I did it with Tim. I did it with Manu. I like leaving my guys sometimes because I feel like I could trap but yet recover back to my man. But you know what? It's going to be difficult, man. You see Kobe, you know, people thought he's slowing down. He scored 30 in, what, 5-6 straight games?
I don't think he's slowing down. I actually thought, because I went to the game, too, that they had against the Jazz, and I thought it was the best I had seen him play in person in a couple months. And he's just – he actually seems like he's getting locked in, and he's not maybe as banged up as people thought he was. So,
he's definitely locked in.
And also somebody that has kind of torched the Suns in the past. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting. Hey, are you going to not talk to him at all? How do you handle that whole thing? You don't want to rile him up, right?
You know what? He doesn't talk to me. You know what? I flopped and got off at the foul, and he gives me a look. He doesn't say anything to me. I don't say anything to him. I'll probably watch more film, but let's be honest. You're not going to stop this guy. I mean, this is one of the best players ever to play the game. I'm going to try to, you know, get under him a little bit, you know, flop, mess around when I foul him, hit that finger, mess around. You know what? It's one of the best players ever to play the game, so. Gotta have definitely all five guys for this guy, and we're not gonna stop him. We're not gonna stop Gasol. We would be lying to you if that was true. But you gotta slow down, find him. You can't let Odom beat you. You can't let Fisher or Artest.
Yeah, is the book on Kobe to just not really say anything to him and hope that he doesn't get ticked off?
Well, the book on Kobe is you gotta attack him. You know, you can't let this guy just play offense. So J.J. Richardson's been key for us in this playoffs. They have to throw him the ball, throw him on the post, have him come off screens, go at him, you know, make him work, and then, you know, defensively give him different looks. There's no looks that we can give him that he hasn't seen. We can trap him, he's seen that, so it's getting physical with him to a certain point, but yet, you know, being smart with it, you know, getting some fouls, and, you know, he can get frustrated too. He's a human like everybody else, so just make it hard on him.
All right. Well, I'm very excited for you. I'm excited for this series, assuming that it's the Lakers. We're taping this. They're up 3-0. I'm assuming they're going to finish this. But
I
think it's going to be fantastic. I mean, is it better for you if the series drags on, or would you rather just know that you're going to play them?
I want to know how to play them. You don't want to, you know, I think a week's enough. I don't want a week in, you know, a week in 3-4 days. 99% chance they win that series, Utah. We know we're going to L.A. most likely. Guys are excited about that, excited about the opportunity. Let's basically get it on, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, because you guys have so much momentum now. I'm not sure a 10-day layoff would really help matters that much.
Yeah, we probably come out, you know, a little flat early on, but you know what? Extra rest for Steve and Grant and Amari, guys that played heavy minutes, wouldn't be too bad, but you know, 7 days is enough. They have enough time to get the massages, nice little R&R, but
yeah.
I think they're excited to get on that court too.
All right, so we can follow you on Twitter, JaredDudley619.
There it is.
And that's where you post your videos, you do some behind-the-scenes stuff, your thoughts about the playoffs, all that stuff. Very entertaining Twitter feed. I recommend it. Jared Dudley, I will see you in Los Angeles. Good luck, my friend.
Come to Hollywood.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, we had a big Red Sox-Yankees series that the Red Sox almost got swept. Thank God they didn't. If you remember the last 2 years, we played a little game called Johnny, Are You Worried Yet? Where I called my buddy Jacko at work, a diehard Yankees fan, and asked him how worried he was about that Yankee season. Unfortunately, the roles have reversed. The Yankees are the 2009 world champions on pace for 100 wins or more, and the Red Sox season is in shambles. So we might have to change this game. Let's give him a ring.
Complex Litigation, this is John.
Oh, Johnny.
Hey there, buddy.
Yeah.
How are you? Okay?
I didn't even tell you I was calling this time.
No, right out of the blue. It's exciting.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's exciting for you.
Well, welcome to...
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
This is America's new favorite running segment. Billy, are you worried yet? And the answer is yes.
I was worried about you Friday night between the Celtics and the Bruins and the Red Sox. My God. And you label it Black Friday, which I was already calling it. I mean, what else could you call it? It was fantastic.
And then you throw in the part where I flew cross country to be there.
Yeah, that hurts.
That part. It was weird. The Sox and the Celtics actually worked against one another because the two games started the exact same time, and it was a traffic quagmire.
Oh, yeah. I can imagine.
So the Celtic game, you know, it was 7-10, and it was two-thirds full. The crowd didn't get there till the end of the first quarter, and we're down 20. It was a disaster. It couldn't have been worse.
You know, if you refuse to do live chats during these big Boston events because you've proved to be a jinx, but
yeah.
Flying back home to be in the city for them, that may be an even bigger jinx.
I know.
Next time there's one of these big events, you may have to go into like a bomb shelter under your house to shut off from society.
Maybe I'll just have to stop following Boston sports entirely.
You might have to.
Yeah, because I've been thinking about going back for game six, and I'm going to stay here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was probably for the best.
I'm going to stay on the West Coast, and where my teams have won 5 championships since I moved. I don't think something happens when I go back now. I don't know what it is. But the Celtics, you know, whatever. The Cavs are a little bit better, and if the Celtics even force a game 7, I'll be fired up. The Red Sox season is much more concerning. For a variety of reasons.
Concerning is a good word, yeah. I think that's a good apt description.
My current problems with the team go like this. Number one, not fun to watch.
No.
Number two, not successful.
No.
Number three, not a lot of hope, considering Tampa and the Yankees are on pace for about 110 wins.
Yeah, that's trouble. I mean, everybody keeps comparing this Red Sox team to last year's Yankees team that stumbled out of the gate, as everyone listens to this podcast and my reaction knows. But the Yankees didn't have anybody running away with the division like the Rays and the Yankees are kind of doing. And they didn't have that competition to face. You know, the Red Sox were okay. The Blue Jays were leading the division for a long time, but everybody knew that that was a fluke, as it turned out to be. So I don't think – and plus A-Rod was coming back from an injury and wasn't A-Rod, and guys were working their way into new – you know, working their way to playing in New York. So I don't think it's quite the same with the Red Sox, although Red Sox fans like to comfort themselves with those comparisons.
Well, the delusional ones do, I think. I'm a lot more concerned. Yeah, I mean – you know, the fact that they gave this extension to Beckett and he's pitched like this is a real, 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 real issue and something that I'm terrified of.
I mean, it's odd. I saw a crazy stat earlier where his April numbers this year were exactly the same as they were last year.
I saw that.
And then he kind of rebounded, but, I mean, to call him an ace, he's not the same pitcher that he was in 07 when he, like, set the world on fire. And I don't understand the haste with which they signed that 4-year extension. Where was he going this year?
Well, I think the counter – I asked Buster Olney, about this and said, like, there's just no big pitchers this winter, so somebody would have overpaid for him. So it became one of those things
down.
He's going to leave if you don't sign him, and if you don't sign him, then who else are you going to get? I don't know.
That third and fourth year of that contract, that's going to be trouble.
I'm starting to wonder if the Teixeira free agent chase – which was December 2008.
Yeah.
Was kind of the bizarro version of the A-Rod chase.
You think it worked out the opposite way of the A-Rod thing, you mean?
Yeah, the A-Rod thing.
Got A-Rod, it blew up in their face for a while.
The A-Rod thing didn't work out for us, and then it looked like a disaster, and we ended up keeping Manny, but then we win 2 World Series because of it. But at the time, people were devastated, and oh my God, oh, the Yankees win again, all that stuff.
Right.
And this time with the Teixeira thing, you guys paid all this money for all these free agents, and then you start out slow, and we're all like, oh, thank God we didn't get to share. He's hitting 190. This is great.
Right.
And now you win the World Series, and, you know, and he had 3 homers on Saturday, which is he's been bad this year, but, you know, he's going to get going. He always does. But
right.
It would be nice to maybe have him in the lineup over the $90 million for John Lackey or whatever that was and something else. I don't know. It's a tough one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's an ongoing debate about the whole Red Sox getting Teixeira thing, and Memphis, you know, he grew up as a Mattingly fan, and I'm not sure that $10 million more dollars, like maybe if Theo just sort of, not literally, but figuratively put a gun to his head when he was down there with the contract and was like, sign here, sign now, let's do it. But I'm not sure if he was ever going to do that with Boris as his agent and wanting to play for the Yankees. I mean, it might just be that he was just the one that you just couldn't get, and he was always going to the Yankees. But it's interesting because it would have taken the franchise in a different direction, certainly.
Yeah, I would agree with that, except that the Red Sox were really, really bitter after that whole whatever they thought was about to happen fell through.
Right.
They had been led to believe as a negotiating ploy or something really did fall through. But either way.
There were some claims, I think, by Gammons maybe where – everything was all set until Lucchino and John Henry got involved, and for some reason that soured Boris and Teixeira, and that blew everything up. Who knows? I don't know if anyone's ever going to resolve what happened there exactly.
Either way,
he's a Yankee.
Well, it's definitely was a fork in the road for the rivalry. I'm not sure if the Red Sox would have been that much better off, or maybe the Yankees win anyway. But it does seem like maybe that's the turning point to some degree.
Could be.
And he's pretty freaking good. Even when he's in a slump, he still can help defensively.
Oh, definitely. I mean, he helps their whole infield. That's what I was going to say. He helps their whole infield defensively because he saves a lot of throws. And he's just so shorthanded back there. It's phenomenal at first base.
Tim McCarver had a good one on Saturday. He goes, I'm not so sure that Mark Teixeira isn't the best right-handed first baseman I have ever seen. Like he said, it took him 10 minutes to say how he does it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like one of those that can't be proven. I need to see a list of the other right-handed first baseman.
Right.
How common is it? He does stand out when you watch him. Like he's clearly much better at playing first base than just about anybody else you're going to see.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to crow a little to the sabermetric community about as being an old school baseball stat crank who never bought into this Red Sox pitching and defense thing, and now it's. It's failed pretty miserably during this first month. Do you have any crowing words?
Well, I mean, specifically, I mean, Adrian Beltre, as John Miller insists on calling him, has committed 7 errors so far, the most by any AL third baseman. And all the sabermetric guys were comparing him to Brooks Robinson. You know, his UGR is wonderful, you know, or whatever it is. His laser and his VORP is amazing. And it's like he's been terrible. So that's why they play games on the field. Now, nobody would have known that because I guess historically he has been good defensively. But, you know, you have to have sort of an old baseball guy that would have looked at Adrian Beltre and said, except for the one year where it was very questionable where he hit 40-something home runs, he's never been a huge standout player. And he's okay defensively, but it's for a different team and a different infield with no pressure. You don't know how the guy's going to handle that, you know? So you can't just look at it mathematically on paper, I don't think, and say, well, the numbers prove this, so this will definitely happen. Humans are fallible and have different ways of working out, and things change in different cities and everything else, and I just don't think you can just crunch it down to numbers and say that's it solely.
Yes, you use the numbers as part of the evaluation, but I think this, you know, it's an early sample size, but... the one thing I think people did forget is that Adrian Beltre was a guy who played in L.A.
Right.
You know, a
laid-back city.
Yeah, laid-back city. Good baseball crowd, but laid-back. Not the same kind of media pressure he would face in a city like Boston. Then goes to Seattle, same thing. You know, getting thrown into this whole Red Sox thing, and if you don't start out well, and he's actually, his bat's been pretty good.
He's got a high average, right?
Yeah, he's not hitting homers, but he's at least been hitting the ball. Usually he starts out slow, but, you know, you just never know with some of these guys until you see them in the big lights. Like Edgar Renteria was a good example. Javi Vasquez, sorry to bring him up. Actually, I'm not. he's a good example.
Right.
Kevin Brown.
Yeah.
Randy Johnson, clearly not somebody made to play in New York. I mean, you've rooted for more of these guys than I think the Red Sox have.
Oh,
some
definitely.
Guys just aren't meant to play in the big cities.
Absolutely.
I'm not saying Beltre is or not, but it's, you know, the 7 errors is a little fishy.
Going back to, I remember being a Yankee fan in the days of Ed Whitson, and he couldn't pitch in New York, and Butch Weiniger, who was a catcher who couldn't play in New York. So the Yankees have had a lot of guys that couldn't make it on the big stage, and I just don't think that – sports is a situation where you can just plug all these numbers into a computer, and then the computer spits out the guys that you should have on your team, and it's always going to work. That's why I'm you know, critical of the whole sabermetric thing and just reducing it all to math. I just don't think you can do it that way. Guys are, you know, I just finished reading the book Ball 4 by Jim Bouton.
Yeah.
Just granted it's 40 years old, but I'd never read it before, and it's, you know, interesting story, you know, stories, and I kind of hated him because he threw the Yankees under the bus repeatedly, and great Yankees under the bus, but it was a fascinating book, and you hear, you know, all the stuff they go through and went through, and they're just guys in the locker room. It's like extended college.
Yeah.
So to have, like, a bunch of guys with, like, a college guy's mentality of, like, drinking and fooling around and doing all kinds of stuff and then playing a game, and you think you can just reduce that to statistics in a computer and it will spit out the perfect team for you, I just don't think it works that way.
I'm torn. I would almost compare myself to one of the Lost characters who's in the current universe and then in the alternate reality universe, where old school me, you know, did not like the Beltrick-Hammer thing because I was worried about them in Boston, most, you know, specifically, just those guys coming through.
Right.
And even Lackey to some degree, who it made me worry just that the Angels fans were not upset at all that he was leaving.
Right.
Old school me didn't like that. They were, why aren't you more upset, you know?
Yeah.
You should be more upset. There should be a red flag. But then on paper, new school me thought everything made sense. Old school me wanted them to sign Johnny Damon, a move that new school me, you know, crunched the numbers and realized that made no sense whatsoever. He's awful defensively.
Right.
At the same time, I knew he could play in a big city.
Yeah, he'd done it before.
Whereas Cameron, 37, not really... You know, mostly small market teams for him.
I mean, the interesting thing, really, from the Red Sox team this year is that they actually have not been terrible offensively.
No.
And what was supposed to be their strengths, the pitching and defense that the whole team was built around, has really failed them. And I mean, I told you when I was out in LA, and I think we talked about it on a podcast. You know, they're starting five on paper before the season. I'm like, geez, that's a freaking good starting five.
Yeah.
Made me a little nervous. And yet they've stumbled out of the gate is an understatement. And their bullpen has been terrible, with the exception of Papelbon. But even guys like Okajima are shaky. The Yankees teed off on Bard the other night, on Friday night, I think it was. Or Saturday, they hit him pretty hard on Saturday. And, you know, Beckett's been terrible. Buchholz has been, we knew what he was. Daisuke is,
Buchholz hasn't been bad. He's had
3-3 though. And
yeah,
he's great against the Yankees.
John, we're not supposed to use win-loss as a reflection of a pitcher's abilities anymore. Know
I'm
that.
Sorry. That's right. And home runs and RBIs don't count either.
It's a team-dependent stat.
Do wins and losses still count? I'm not sure. For the team? I don't know how that works.
There's much better ways to measure a pitcher now. I want to have Jonah Carey. We're going to have you and Jonah Carey have a debate that I'm going to moderate. No, I mean, it's going to be a debate. It's going to be like a political thing where you each have 2 minutes to make your points, and then I intervene with more questions.
Okay.
I think that'll be fun.
Yeah, that would be good.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, it's been funny. It just the, you know, the Red Sox strengths have really, really not borne themselves out yet, I would say.
Mm. Well, it's not like the Yankees are really a house of fire either, and yet somehow their record's really good.
Well, their starting pitching has been unbelievable. I mean, before last night when Burnett, we know, Burnett has a shaky one, and unfortunately they always seem to come against the Red Sox on his roller coaster ride, but I think before last night, their starters were like 16-1 with an ERA right around 2. So now they're 16-2, I believe. I mean, Hughes is 4-0. Pettit's 3-0, I think. Sabathia should have got the win the other day, but he didn't. You know, the rains came before he could get one more out. You know, he's 3-1, 4-1, I think. So, and they all have ERAs in like the low 2s. So it's really been phenomenal starting pitching, with the exception, of course, I should say, among 4 of our starters, with the exception, of course, of Mr. Vasquez.
Yes. I forgot to throw him in.
Who's been an atrocity. But the Yankees are, what are they now, 21-9, with Teixeira hitting under 200, with Nick Johnson as a corpse, essentially, and A-Rod not doing much. Now, Cano's been setting the world on fire, but they also have been getting, you know, Swisher's been hot, and guys like Cervelli, and Gardner's been great, and Cervelli's been filling in nicely as a backup. Could be a Wally Pipp situation with Jorge.
Well, it seems like the two guys that have exceeded all expectations are Hughes and Cervelli.
Yes. Yes.
Although I really liked Hughes. I thought Hughes was a legitimate fantasy sleeper, and I've always been a fan, and I always thought that eventually he was going to put it together. But Cervelli,
yeah.
Nazi.
I mean, it's been for a couple of years now, he's been the next big thing, and he might finally be rounding into the next big thing finally right before our eyes. I mean, he's been fantastic.
Well, I was watching the game 2 years ago when he had the no-hitter in Texas, and then he got hurt.
Right.
But watching that game, you're just like, all right, this guy's going to eventually be really good.
And I think last year, pitching in the eighth inning gave him some confidence because he had really good games there. Yeah. And now that he has some confidence and he can put it all together, he's been phenomenal for him. And Sabathia is good. And Burnett had been good up until last night. For some reason, he can't pitch against the Red Sox. But
where did Cervelli come from? I don't understand this, that he is now this guy who's going to get 400 at-bats and put up good stats, and he's been good behind the plate. Like, how does this happen?
I think the Yankees farm system has been underrated because, you know, years ago everybody was like, well, Qingming Wang's not that good, and Cano's not that good, and they weren't that highly regarded in the minors, and then they came up to the majors, and they were great. And the same thing, the Cervelli came out of the minors, and he was doing lousy in the minors. He was hitting in the 200s, I think, but they had to bring him up last year when I think Jose Molina actually was hurt for a long period of time, and they brought Cervelli up, and he just flourished in the majors.
Ooh, it sounds like he got the old FedEx package put in the locker.
It could be.
One-way address from the Dominican. Hey, Francisco.
Yeah, well, he's from Venezuela, so.
Try these.
Who knows what they have in the drugstores in Venezuela, but yeah, I mean, but not just offensively, he's a really good catcher, too. Last night, Joe Morgan was saying how Girardi was, I think it was Joe Morgan, or somebody was saying how Girardi was drooling over his ability as a receiver.
Drooling.
So he was like, you know, not literally drooling, but my words, not Joe Morgan's, but
yes.
How Girardi was effusive in his praise of his abilities as a defensive catcher. So
you think A-Rod had a big thing of pills in his hand? He's like, hey, ASA, try these.
Try some of these, maybe.
It's a little fishy, Johnny. I'd like to see him pee in a cup soon.
Yeah, I hope Pedroia pisses in the same one.
Because Posada's catching was the secret. Not even a secret. It was the open weakness of this current Yankees team, and it's immediately gone away.
Right. Now, I like Jorge. It's taken me years to say that because he was such a shaky catcher. And he, you know, I hated seeing balls bounce off his glove and careen around home plate, but I've learned to like Jorge for his offense, but he's not a very good defensive catcher at all. It's an Achilles heel of them. So now if you have Cervelli, and I like Cervelli, he's excitable. He's, you know, pumping the fist. He gets up.
I agree.
Base.
Yeah.
He's like lively, you know, it's pretty good.
Yeah. It's nice to see players show emotion. I'm not used to it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. The Boston Robots, they don't do a lot of that.
I was worried about what would happen if we had a bench clearing brawl, like what my team would be capable of. I spent like 5 minutes thinking about it on Saturday. Like, I really hope this isn't a brawl. I think this could be really embarrassing.
Well, it was shaping up that way because, you know, Friday night when Beckett lost it, and he was plunking guys left and right. And, you know, if the Red Sox didn't completely own the commissioner, he'd be suspended. But, of course, he won't be.
How dare you.
And, you know, they said that Sabathia and A-Rod and I think Posada were up on the top step, like, barking at him and barking at the ump. And you know, with Sabathia pitching the next day, that he was not going to be afraid to hit somebody. And I was excited, hoping that would lead to something. But Pedroia, I got to give him credit. He took it and went to first. He knew what the deal was.
Yeah, because I don't think Pedroia was going to be charging CC Sabathia
no,
anytime
right.
soon. That would have been the biggest weight difference, I think, in the history of bench clearing brawls.
Yeah, he definitely picked the right guy to hit. That's for sure.
That would have been awesome.
If I had to make one,
well, if I had to make one sports wish for 2010, I think it would be Pedroia charging CC Sabathia.
You know, I could see him having it in him though. Like he doesn't seem like a guy that's going to back down. Like Pedroia wouldn't be afraid. I don't think.
I think he'd come out with the bat at that point.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, it could have been the Johnny Roseborough, Juan Marichal deal.
You have to use it, but I think people would understand. Yeah, I mean, the guy does have 200 pounds on him. He needed something.
Right.
Maybe throw the bat. I don't know. Yeah, that's where we needed, you know, like when I was living in Boston near the end there, we had the Trot Nixon. Was at least the one guy I knew would have everybody's back in the bench clear.
Right.
I'm not sure who that guy is, though. Yankees have a couple.
Well, I mean, you know, Euclid and Pedroia would probably be into it, but I don't know if anybody else would be.
I don't know about
Euclid. Scudero, maybe?
Euclid Scott had a bad performance in the Tampa brawl that time.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Trot, I felt like, would fight to the death.
Well, Beckett would. Beckett, Pedroia, Papelbon.
Oh, Papelbon would be good, but it would take him 20 seconds to get out of the bullpen.
Yeah, that's true. Plus, he's pretty fond of the Yankees. He wants to go pitch there, so he may not go after them.
I love the fact that A-Rod was barking from the dugout.
Yeah.
How many altercations has A-Rod been in?
Well, controversy is a way of finding A-Rod. And then
but never in a real fight. It's always like the only time was when Veritek plowed him in the face that one time.
Yeah. But, you know, then he did the thing in Toronto where he supposedly yelled, hey, if a guy was trying to catch a pop-up.
Yeah.
So they don't, and then the whole thing with Dallas Braden.
Yeah.
And then I knew it was going to be a bad day for the Yankees yesterday when Dallas Braden pitched the perfect game. I knew that was going to be trouble.
That's going to be exciting when he pitches against them again.
Well, yeah, they come back, and it's like around the 4th of July, July 5th, they come into New York.
I'm excited for that
one. Too bad pitchers don't hit because he would definitely take one in the ribs.
Have you stopped calling Marcus Thames Marcus Thames yet? Takes like a month, right? I had him on my fantasy team once, and I just kept calling him Marcus Thames.
Yeah, Marcus had an adventure in the outfield last night. He wasn't really setting the world on fire out there as the left fielder, but he's been hitting well this year. He was hitting over 400, granted in limited at-bats, but still.
Are you worried about the Rays?
Yeah, a little bit. And so I read in the paper that they apparently have had like the easiest schedule in the American League.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they're legit. I mean, they have a legit offense, and they have a legit rotation, very good rotation. I think their bullpen's a little shaky.
And a legit identity.
Yeah, they're scrappy.
They're the athletic team that keeps coming and wears you down. And not a bad, not a good matchup for the Boston Red Sox.
No, they're going to run all over the Red Sox. Yeah. And, yeah, no, the Rays are scrappy. They'll be there all year. I mean, you know, and I would like to count the Red Sox out, but I think they have a way of rising from the dead, unfortunately, so... But well, I feel good.
I'm worried because I don't want us to stay just close enough where we have, like, the puncher's chance so that everybody will bully them into, you know, the one or two trades this summer that won't ultimately help us. I'd rather just see us bottom out than kind of be half-heartedly in the race when we're clearly not going to get a playoff.
Well, that's what causes your problems when you're kind of hanging around but not really.
Yeah. You don't want to hang around.
Because, I mean... You know, they could, if they're sellers, they could probably get some things for like Papelbon and Victor Martinez and get some prospects and just bring up and go with a youth movement.
Oh, please, how dare you not put J.D. Drew in that sentence,
well,
the other two.
It depends how much you want to pay him a salary, I think.
I'm trying to brainwash the San Francisco Giants front office into trading for him. The Giants fans, I mentioned this in the podcast, the Giants fans got mad. They're like, we already have a right fielder. Stop pushing it. Don't. Somebody might listen to that.
My favorite thing in the world is reading the comments on the Boston Globe after they go on a losing streak and especially when they lost to the Yankees. Because, as you know, like, I don't sleep anyway, so I'm up at like 5 o'clock in the morning. I was literally on my computer at like 5:05 on Sunday morning to read the comments on the Boston Globe. I'm so excited. And when I love any trade prospect that involves Big Poppy as a major piece of the trade. Trade Big Poppy and Dice K. Yeah, teams are like banging down your door looking for those two.
And Dice K has a no-trade clause.
Right, exactly.
He might be the most untradeable player in the history of baseball.
Right.
No-trade clause, and nobody wants him. It's a bad combo.
Yeah, like the Padres are like, please can we give you Adrian Gonzalez for Big Poppy and Dice K? When do we sign the papers for that, right?
Well, it's going to be interesting. You know, they win two World Series.
Mm.
But now this team they've built is not great. And they also don't really have the farm system that I think people assume they're going to have with how much money they're spending on all these guys.
And, I mean, I think a lot of that farm system, they have a great propaganda arm, the Red Sox. And,
they do.
And
I'm not going
to
lie.
I don't mean that to throw them under the bus. Like, I'm saying, like,
right.
Kudos to them. And they hype up these prospects like they're the greatest players since Cy Young. And then, like, who was the guy they traded to the Indians for Victor Martinez?
They have a way. Well, they have a couple media writers with some influence.
You know, these guys are, oh, my God. Like, I've heard about Lars Anderson for 3 years now. He's going to be the next great thing. Or Buchholz, or I can't remember the guy that they traded away now from Victor Martinez, the pitcher. But you don't hear anything about him anymore.
Masterson.
Yeah,
he's getting
exactly.
Shelled all season.
Yeah,
yeah,
you don't hear anything about him. And he was supposed to be the greatest thing since sliced bread. And it's like they got a great hype and other teams buy into it. But then these guys never really develop. And that's the whole thing with the bridge year. It's supposed to be a bridge to, like, the prospects. But what if the prospects suck?
Well, there's not a lot of them either. They're not teaming. It's not like the Rays. I can't stop calling them Devil Rays. But
no.
The Rays are just, they're pumping guys out left and right. It's like a factory. The Red Sox only have a couple. Now they're trying to push this, the Cuban shortstop, who's this apparently a defensive whiz and...
Yeah, Echeverria or something like that.
Yeah,
that it?
Whatever his name is. But
and Casey Kelly, you know, who's like a shortstop turned into a pitcher, and you know.
They lost Westmoreland, which really hurt.
Yeah, that, unfortunately, because he hit some health issues. But
Hench and I made a rule 3 years ago that we, in our League of Dorks, where we had the minor league draft, that crazy league, that we weren't going to buy into the Red Sox hype anymore. And then last year, Justin Tozales, second round.
Oh, my God.
He'll be the last Red Sox rookie we ever, or prospect we ever draft. Somehow he got sucked back into, oh, sinker baller. Oh, it could be up by midseason. They do it. This is what they do every year.
Right. They got a good propaganda arm, but it, you know, these guys never quite materialize, it seems like.
And meanwhile, with the Yankees, it's kind of the opposite.
Yeah, you never hear anything, and then suddenly Cervelli and Cano are possible all-stars.
Well, I was even thinking Austin Jackson, who
right.
was their one allegedly good prospect that nobody trusted his potential because he was a Yankee farm guy. And
right.
just the Yankees have so few guys, everyone thought they were kind of overselling this guy, and now he's leading the league in batting.
Yeah, I know. It's ridiculous. He's put Detroit on his back, along with Damon.
If I had thought of this sooner, I would have played the clip of you bitching about the Phil Hughes, Johan Santana,
yes.
Santana non-trade.
I know. Buddies of mine have been emailing me, and they're like, I guess we're happy now we didn't trade Phil Hughes for Santana. And I'm like, yes, Cashman knows better than I did, as it turned out.
Go Santana, he's throwing 90. Santana.
I'm not sure that Cashman knows better about me when it comes to Nick Johnson and Javier Vasquez, though.
Yeah, that might be true. Well, the Nick Johnson thing's weird because I do feel like if the future of Earth was at stake and we needed to pick one major leaguer to draw a walk off some alien submariner,
yeah,
wouldn't you pick Nick Johnson? You just need a walk, and then we're going to have a base runner for you. All we need to do is get on base. You maybe go with Nick Johnson.
Yeah, I certainly would, but I'm willing to make a deal with the Yankees. I think his salary is $12 million. I'm willing to play for half that, and I won't swing the bat either. I'll just look him over, too. I could walk every once in a while, too.
I just want to see somebody throw 75-mile-an-hour lollipops at him, just begging him.
Yeah.
Here you go, Nick. Here's another one right down the middle. Come on, swing. Swing it.
And, I mean,
swing.
The injury thing with him, I mean, we had this the first go-around, that he just is one of these guys that breaks down every other game, and he's on the DL, and now it happened again. I mean, are we surprised by this?
Yeah, this is where I think, back to the whole stats movement, they're starting to research that stuff more, like if injuries and stuff like that is – you know, not a fluke as much as something that's a real DNA thing almost.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, because it does seem to be that there's these guys that just always get injured.
Yeah, whether so, you know, there's the occasional case when it could be bad luck, but for the most part, it does seem like some bodies are more predisposed to break down than others. I'd like to include myself in that conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
I know my body is predisposed to breaking down.
Yeah.
But other people, you know, I look at my son, who's 2.5.
Indestructible.
He's a killing machine. He's assuming his height, we're starting to get worried he might be short. He had some kid come over the other day, and the kid was like a full head over him. And I was like, how old is that kid? And he's like, oh, he's a week older than our son. And I was like, oh, no. He's not going to be the handsome short guy who's good at sports, I hope. Soccer, he'd be a soccer lacrosse kid.
But you're tall. And your wife's fairly tall, right?
Well,
I've
been hanging him upside down by his feet, trying to lengthen him.
How tall is the mailman? Your son, when we were out in L.A., though, like he's just a bruiser, like climbing up on top of things and jumping off of them. And
that's the thing.
The best is when he carries this little table that he uses to climb up on top of things. And me and you in house were watching the basketball. And he, like, opened the door and literally threw the table out, like the Incredible Hulk, and then turned to us and said, bye, and, like, went through the door. It was like an action movie. Like, he just killed everybody in the room and then just said, bye, and left. It was fantastic. We laughed for about 10 minutes.
Yeah, we were flipping channels, and we realized that he's Bam Bam Flintstone.
Yeah, he really is. Yeah, he definitely is.
But back to the point, he's not somebody that I just think he's the way his body is.
He'll never have any kind of sports injury.
Yeah, whereas me, I had glasses when I was 5, and, you know, I'm skinny, I'm always getting hurt.
Right.
You know, I think it's – so, yeah, I don't know if that's going to be the big ground that is plowed over these next 10 years where people try to figure if injuries are, like, a real thing.
Right.
Like a DNA thing.
Yes, it's a distinct possibility.
And then the other thing, obviously, would be psychological. They're going to make some advancements with that and try to figure out, like, exactly why Javi Vasquez
– right.
can only pitch in a small market.
You show him pictures of the Empire State Building and he wets himself. That's maybe a sign that you don't want to bring him back to New York.
But is there some sort of psychological profile that translates to somebody just being better in a small market? Is it like the way you're raised? Is it something that happened to you as a kid? Like, you know.
Yeah. I mean, there's got to be advancements in science, or the testing they give in the NFL, right?
Yeah.
That's what they need in baseball. One of these, like, what do they call that thing? I can't even think of it.
The Wonderlic.
The Wonderlic test. You know, psychological testing, and it measures your whole persona, you know, teams can use that as an evaluation tool. It's what they need.
Mm. So I'm guessing you're about a 1 out of 10 being worried this week?
Yeah.
I guess we have to flip this around, because why would you be worried? You won the title last year.
You know, one other thing I didn't realize last time we had a podcast, and it was right after the opening series. I didn't realize that the Red Sox did this thing where they brought this kid on the field that does the Herb Brooks impersonation from Miracle.
Yeah.
That I've seen at hockey games and everything. And the kid's cute, and he does the Herb Brooks impersonation, and it's funny. But he, like, went on the field, and he's like, I'm sick and tired. And in Herb Brooks' thing, he's like, I'm sick and tired of hearing about the Soviet Union. And then he goes, screw them! Which is what Herb Brooks apparently really said before the game against Russia in the Miracle on Ice. But the kid, like, came out on the field and said that about the Yankees, and then he's like, screw them.
Mm.
I mean, not to whine about it or cry, because I don't really care, and I'm sure the Yankees care even less than I do, but the Red Sox won the World Series in 04 and 07. I mean, and then all I hear all weekend on it came through loud and clear on the TV is the Yankees suck chant. At some point, can't the Red Sox fans act like they've been there before? The 86-year thing is over with. I mean, can we just get beyond it and have some degree of... Because you would never have that kid at Yankee Stadium saying, like, I'm sick and tired of hearing the Red Sox, screw them. Like, the Yankee fans just... Yankees just wouldn't do that. It's kind of a classless move, I think.
I'm going to defend the Red Sox fans. This is my... You knew I would.
Yeah, of course.
It's kind of just in our DNA to hate the Yankees. That's what we grew up with. That's what we... that's what was built into us for...
Decades. I mean,
it's a hard thing to just drop and say, all right, time to not hate them anymore.
I mean, I think you would, it's kind of like a little brother, big brother thing that it had been for 86 years. You would hope that after they won it, that they would think that they were on equal footing, but they still have an inferiority complex. That they have to lash out and be bitter, and now karma's biting them in the ass.
Yeah. I have to think about this. Say, inferiority complex is a strong word.
I'm going to stand by it.
It's a strong word, though, Johnny. Like, I was in Orlando last week for the NBA playoffs, and the Magic fans have an inferiority complex. Like, it makes them angry that nobody discusses them as a title favorite, and, you know, they're just very upset about it, and they feel like it's because they're a small market, and nobody takes them seriously. And
expansion team. They've been in existence for, what, like 20 years?
Yeah.
Yeah, they should have one. Nobody does think about them. They are an afterthought.
And you know what's not helping for them? They hand out those Mr. Miyagi Karate Kid 2 things that you make the noise with. You flick your wrists and the ball bounces back and forth on the board.
Oh, my God, really?
Yeah, they hand those out for playoff games. I think you got to stop doing that before people maybe take you a little bit more seriously. What are those called? The Miyagi whatevers?
I don't know. I know what you're talking about, but I don't know what they're called.
Yeah.
Yeah, anytime you're handing things out like that, you deserve the inferiority complex.
I was watching Kid 3. A couple weeks ago with Holy Cross's own Thomas Ian Griffith.
Yes.
I hadn't seen it in a while.
You know, Thomas Ian Griffith and I, but not only did we go to Holy Cross, but we also went to the same high school.
Yeah, you guys are linked in a lot of ways.
Pretty impressive, isn't it?
Hadn't seen it in a while. I just feel like I need to watch that movie once a year. That's how much I enjoy it. It might be my favorite out of the three now.
Well, as we've discussed before on this, I think it was always mystifying to us in college that this millionaire playboy that could do anything he wanted with his life decided to risk his fame and fortune on persecuting a 17-year-old.
who's like 40 in the movie.
Well, in real life, yeah.
But it's like one of those, it's like how you watch The Godfather and you pick up things you didn't, I never noticed that, you know, like an epic movie like that. I feel Karate Kid 3 is in that same class.
And if he really wanted to help out his buddy rather than, like, try to destroy Daniel LaRusso or whatever his name is, like if you're that, why don't you just buy his house and foreclose on it? Like, that would get even with him. You know? Like, you're going to go through this thing like, oh, sorry, I'd love to be there for that board meeting, but I have to go and build up this karate kid who's 17 years old so I can later destroy him. I'll catch up with you later.
The thing I noticed this time that I'd never noticed before is the loophole of... it's the All-Valley Karate Tournament, and Daniel San's the defending champion.
Yeah.
So they make a rule... He's telling Miyagi, because he's trying to get Miyagi to sign the parent waiver. We don't know where Daniel's mom is. She apparently had some strip club, like doing heroin or something. And he's like, they made a new rule this year. I only have to fight in the finals. The defending champion only has to defend the title in the finals. And I'm thinking, like, in what sport or tournament would they ever make that rule? in a million trillion years. When would that rule ever happen?
It's just the America's Cup and the All Valley Karate Championships in Los Angeles.
Can you imagine if they made that rule in the Olympics? Like, a little wrinkle this year for the gold medal game. The defending champ from 4 years ago only has to play the gold medal game this year. So then I was thinking, and it's like, by the way, it's like 2:30 in the morning. I can't sleep. So then I'm thinking, like, what would have made them want to make that rule? Because, like, there's a couple problems. First of all, the more karate scenes, the better, I really feel like, with a Karate Kid movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you kind of want the tournament montage. They just could have ripped off You're the Best and made it a different song and just had him fight all these people again. Nobody's against that. Nobody's like, oh, no, I know the karate montage. I'm going to go get some popcorn. Like, people are excited for that. But instead, they have 20 minutes of him and Miyagi, like, you know, free falling down this hill to plant a bonsai tree.
Yes.
So at some point in the writers' meeting, they were like, should we take out 5 minutes of the bonsai tree footage? Or should we have the karate montage? And everybody's like, bonsai. All right, 4 votes bonsai, 1 karate montage. Well, we'll go with the bonsai.
Well, not to mention in the first one, Zabka was not automatically in the finals, was he?
No, he had to go through.
So
well,
what
happened
that year? Like, did the champion, did he retire the year before and it was open, or what happened?
No, Daniel-san tells Miyagi that this year they've changed the rule.
Oh, they did. He points that out.
So the champion only has to fight in the finals. He's like, come on, it's one fight. So,
you know what it could have been is that Ralph Macchio's gout could have been acting up, or his arthritis.
Well, that's
he's like, I only have so many fights in me.
At about 2:45, that was the conclusion I came to, was that, because he's really fat in this movie. Like, as I've written, you know, in the Karate Kid article, he has a woman's ass in this movie, and he's actually has a gut. And there are scenes where he's got his shirt tucked into his pants, and he has a gut that a 45-year-old man would have with a woman's ass. So I think at some point they just saw how out of shape he was, and they thought, we've got to protect Macchio.
Yeah.
So when you watch the actual fight scene, he doesn't do any karate in the fight scenes. The guy, the sensei, says to Mike Barnes, he says, what I want you to do is get a point and then get a penalty point back. He's basically like, you know, win a point, then cheat. And the goal was, I just want to punish him. I want to punish him for 3 minutes.
Right.
And then
okay.
You'll win it in sudden death. So Mike Barnes comes out and he does karate moves. He gets a point. Then the next time he does a cheap shot and they take the point away, and that's how they do it for 3 minutes. But Macchio never actually does any karate.
Really?
All he does is just take a beating and fall over and get the crap kicked out of him. And then he finally pulls off like one in the final move. He throws the guy over and does one move. And I'm convinced it's because he was out of shape.
It must be. That's the only plausible explanation.
The point is, Johnny, with an epic movie, whether it's Godfather, Karate Kid 3, whatever, you never know what you're going to find the next time you watch it.
If I'm Thomas Ian Griffith, I'm going to foreclose on Daniel-san's house, and I'm going to pay off an immigration agent to look at Mr. Miyagi's immigration status. And then I'm going to say to my buddy, are we all square now? We're good?
Yeah, we're good. It took me 10 minutes. I got to go back to my life as a billionaire now.
Exactly.
It is great. It's really – there was this period of time from, I'm going to say, 1988 to about 92 – before people started to grasp on the unintentional comedy. Because I think Toy Soldiers is like this, too. This is another movie I watch all the time and just pick apart. Where they had no idea. Like, they were dead serious when they were making these movies. They just had no idea.
Oh, yeah. Well, how about Over the Top with Sylvester Stallone?
That's another one. Yeah, maybe it goes from, like, 86 to 92.
Where, like, the child custody issues were settled by arm wrestling. I don't think that really would happen in real life.
When's the last time you watched Toy Soldiers?
It's been a while. That's the one with Sean Astin.
Yeah.
And they take over the prep school, and then he fights them off or whatever.
Yeah, they have terrorists in the prep school. And Lou Gossett's the headmaster.
Right.
And they're like, you know, we're going to go in. We got to get these kids. And Lou Gossett says, Sean Astin's name is Billy in the movie.
Yeah.
And Lou Gossett says, we better give Billy, he basically tells him, let's give Billy a day to try to figure this out. Billy's like the 17-year-old screw-up who, at the start of the movie, he's almost going to get suspended for the 10th time.
Right.
Just something about Billy that caught Lou Gossett's eye and made him think, this might be the guy that could foil these 20 terrorists.
Well, there's, you know, speaking of Lou Gossett, another one, of course, is Iron Eagle, where the teenager leads an invasion of Libya to free his father.
Yeah, well,
by stealing
a
fighter plane.
I thought that was realistic.
there's like 8 million ways that could never, ever even come close to happening.
Yes, but you're probably right. Toy Soldiers has the classic part where Sean Astin escapes with the plan they've written where all the terrorists are.
Right.
And then he's like, I got to go back. And they're like, no, we can't let him go back. So now he's escaping the FBI and the terrorists because he's got to get rid of it. He steals a car and somehow gets back in. But if you haven't seen it in a while, I highly urge you to watch the scene with Will Wheaton. When Will Wheaton is released because his dad is a mafioso. And the terrorists, they call Will Wheaton and they're like, we're letting you go. We respect your father. And this just enrages Will Wheaton. So they're bringing him out and he grabs the henchman's machine gun, knocks him out, and then runs outside the school and just does like the Rambo, starts shooting and just gets gunned down. Okay.
Oh, I've got to rent this now. It's been a while since I've seen this.
You don't need to rent it. It's on cable.
All right. I'll keep my eye out for that then.
Well, this is what I'm going to do now that my Red Sox season is in shambles. I'm going to watch bad movies.
Yes.
And that's what I'll be calling you about over talking about my own team.
The 80s video music montage that was just an excuse to have like a music video within the movie.
Yes.
All right.
Johnny, I'm a 9.5 out of 10 this week. Billy,
fantastic.
Are you worried yet?
And, maybe that's the highest you've ever been, I think.
I'd be a 10 if it were, if I should probably be a 10, right?
Yeah. Well, 9.5 is good. It gives you some room to grow.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Later.
Target the center. Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.